Wow, that tongue thing is amazing. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that's missing a left shoe. When you think of the films of Michael Bay, what comes to mind? Skyline-filling explosions, screeching car chases, or giant robots smashing into each other? Or maybe it's his obsession with hyperkinetic editing, 360-degree camera shots, and saturated color palettes. What you typically don't associate with the inventor of Bayhem is an exploration of philosophical and ethical questions. Nevertheless, that's what the former music video director attempted, well, kind of, with the film we're reviewing here, 2005's The Island. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who always has five rashers of bacon with his breakfast. It is my good friend Nick Rehack. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great because today I got a sixth ration.
Well, a moment on the lips, a lifetime of clogging your arteries. That's the expression when it comes to red meat and saturated fats. I think that's the story there.
Unfortunately, it is.
Now, Nick, before we go any further, I need to tell you about some feedback we have had on our last episode. One of our listeners, Matthew Ormrod, emailed me about the discussion that we had about the Sentinel. Now, in that film, we get to see the presidential helicopter Marine One explode, and I listed some of the other films where we get to see POTUS's copter blow up. Now, Matthew got in touch to point out that I had actually missed off a film from the list that I read out on that particular episode. And he reminded me that My Fellow Americans, a 90s comedy with Jack Lemmon and James Garner, also features Marine One being blown up. Now, firstly, I need to apologise to Matthew and our other listeners, if there are indeed any, for this particular error. I did know about this particular helicopter explosion. I just happened to miss it off my list. Now, that said, we do here at Exploding Helicopter strive to be the foremost authority on the subject of chopper fireballs in films. So this was a very poor mistake on my part. But more excitingly, I guess it just goes to show that this subgenre of presidential chopper fireballs is even larger than we thought. Now, how excited are you, Nick, about being able to watch yet another film with Marine One exploding?
I mean, it is pretty interesting that it's going to be in more of a comedic film than, like, assumedly an action film. But the fact that Jack Lemmon is in a film with an exploding helicopter in itself, I think, is really impressive, because that's not someone that you would expect to be, in that type of situation or that type of film.
He really isn't. And yeah, it's, I guess, just a tribute to the longevity of his career that he did manage to linger around long enough in Hollywood to finally find his way into a film with an exploding helicopter. But you raise a very good question. Who is the strangest actor to have an exploding helicopter film on his CV? I mean, I'm not expecting an answer from you now, Nick, but I think it's a question we should definitely return to at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm for that. I'm very much for that.
Well, now we've got the housekeeping out of the way. Let's get this episode back on track. And we're talking about a Michael Bay film here. And in the world of cinema, I think it's fair to say that old Mikey doesn't have the best of reputations. I mean, his name's pretty synonymous with a certain type of soulless, style over substance blockbuster filmmaking. Yet, despite that, he's made hugely popular, commercially successful films. So despite all the derision, people are going out there, going into cinemas and watching his films. So where do you sit on this particular argument here? What are your thoughts on Michael Bay?
If I go see a Wes Anderson film, I know exactly what I'm going to see. If I go to see a Michael Bay film, I know exactly what I'm going to see. If I go to see a Scorsese film, I know there's going to be Rolling Stones in the soundtrack. If I hear that Michael Bay is the director, I know immediately, all right, expect a lot of cuts, expected a lot of hyperaction, just a lot of color, and just like you said, style over substance. I'm totally okay with that, because sometimes movies are meant to be an escape. Movies are meant to transport us into a world, and maybe that world is full of Transformers that are running around and destroying everything. Maybe that's a world where, you know, everything that happens in Armageddon, or maybe it's a world where, you know, we're with two police officers a la Bad Boys. Like, I know what I'm getting into when I see his films, and I'm totally okay with that, because there's a place for all types of films. There's a place for all types of storytelling, be it good storytelling and not so good storytelling. I'm okay with him as a director. Is he going to crack my top 10 or 15 or 20? Probably not, but I've yet to see a film of his where I'm like, oh, I can never watch that again. That was horrible.
Yeah, I mean, as I get older, I find myself less inclined. I just don't have the energy to really get sort of wound up by directors that I don't particularly care for. And yeah, Michael Bay, I don't like the Transformers films, but you know, they're not really aimed at me. They're aimed at, you know, 8 or 9 year old boys, I imagine. So, you know, they're not really gonna work for me. And the rest of his films, I mean, I don't particularly care for them, but they're not horrendous. I mean, sometimes I wish he wouldn't cut quite so much, but at the end of the day, I mean, there's so much worse in the world that I find it hard to get particularly steamed up about what Michael Bay does or doesn't do, you know, in a camera lens or so forth. So, yeah, I mean, but I mean, I'm fairly nonplussed by the work of Michael Bay. Is there anything of his that you think, you know what, I actually like that film, that's a good film?
I kind of enjoy, it's funny you mentioned the Transformers films, I kind of enjoy the Transformers films, but it's because it's the kid in me. It's the kid in me that grew up with the toys, that grew up with the cartoons. It's the kid in me that loves Godzilla and other kaiju films. Just seeing big, dumb robots fight each other, that's just fun and cool. You know, I understand that it's not the highest of art. You're not going to get the best jokes, but you're going to see some robots fighting each other. And that's just kind of fun, because I don't really have the time anymore as a kid to use my imagination with action figures and make them fight. I don't always have time to just build with Legos and then tear them all down after, you know, building whatever I've built and creation to destroy it. Like, sometimes I just want that to be unfolded for me, and the Transformers movies do that. Now, do I watch them all the time? Is it like something that, oh, it's time for the yearly Transformers marathon? Absolutely not. But if they're on, or I'm in the mood for something like really, really silly, yeah, I'm going to watch it and probably have a decent enough time and fast forward just to get to the fight parts. Like, you know, I even went and saw the most recent one, Transformers Rise of the Beasts, or Beast, yes. Whatever it is.
I think it was Rise of the Beasts.
Yeah, but I'm going to see it because it's silly. Like, it's so silly a premise. Why not?
Okay, I think it's time to get stuck into the island. But before we do that, we need to hear the result of the lottery.
Attention residents, welcome to the lottery spin. Jordan 2 Delta, you're moving out to the island. Transported to the world's last paradise.
I think they're gonna kill you.
I'm going to the island.
There is no island! Come on!
Stop right there!
Two of our products have escaped.
Run!
Go, go, go! Do not let him get away!
Tell me what's going on.
You're copies of people out here in the world.
They're simply tools, instruments. They have no souls.
How come we never did this before?
People will do anything to survive.
Go, Lincoln! Go, Lincoln!
The island follows the story of Lincoln 6 Echo and Jordan 2 Delta, who live in an isolated, highly controlled facility. They believe they are the survivors of a global contamination, and that their only hope for leaving the underground complex is to win a lottery that allows them to go to the island, which is the last uncontaminated place on Earth. However, as the story unfolds, Lincoln starts to question the nature of their existence and the truth behind the facility. He discovers that they are actually clones created for organ harvesting, and the existence of the island is a lie. Determined to escape and survive, Lincoln and Jordan make a daring break from the facility and embark on a journey to uncover the truth about their origins while being relentlessly pursued by mercenaries hired to capture them. The film stars Ewan McGregor, Scarlett Johansson, Jimon Hounsou, I think I butchered that terribly, I'm going to move on, Sean Bean and Steve Buscemi. When it came out, The Island failed to land any wholly positive reviews, with critics falling into one of two camps, those that felt it was either okay or those that completely slammed it. The Island has a 6.8 rating on IMDb and a 2.9 out of 5 rating on Letterboxd. At the box office, the film was got a worldwide gross of $167 million against a budget of $126 million. So it would have been considered a bit of a box office disappointment. But with all of that out of the way, Nick, what did you make of The Island?
I thought it was fun, and I enjoyed enough of it, but my biggest problem is the tone, the pacing, and just overall what it's trying to do and get across. I really dug the concept. I think there's a lot of promise here, but I don't think it's as well executed as it could be.
I'm in pretty much agreement with you, but yeah, why don't you, yeah, can you sort of unpack that a little bit? I mean, you know, you said you were excited by the concept. What excited you, and then what disappointed you about the execution?
I think what excites me is it's the whole idea of, hey, they're going to win this lottery and they're going to go to this island, because you're kind of just in this world and you don't really know what's going on. And that alone is exciting. Like, okay, there's several mysteries that we're unfurling here. Not only is it the mystery of what this particular world is like, the mystery of these characters and what's going on, but the mystery of this island, right? The film is even called The Island, so here we're going to go to this island. And this was my first time seeing the film for this. I remember the trailers when they came out, but I didn't remember anything outside of it. It was a Michael Bay film with Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson in it. So as it unfolded, I just became more and more exciting, even with some of the turns and the direction it heads. I'm like, okay, this is fun. After a while, it became a little color by numbers. You could figure out what was going on. But there's a lot of humor that I feel like these jokes were written in the 80s or maybe even the very early 90s. Like, they just weren't original. I felt like they nailed the concept. I feel like they visually, it's a lot of fun, but I just think the dialogue and everything that's happening in between just doesn't do it. I feel like it takes away every single time. Like, as soon as I start to enjoy it, there's a joke that just, it falls really flat, or is just dumb or pointless, or something extends for way longer than it should, and it keeps me from like really enjoying it and being a massive fan of it. If you were to cut 10-15 minutes out of this, maybe ditch a joke or two, I think you'd have a fantastic film that is underrated and a cult following and people love it, and it's one of those like 30 years removed, everyone realizes how great a movie it is. I think you'd have one of those. But there's times where it's like, okay, are we watching a more serious action film with little comedy bits sprinkled in, or is this just a straight up comedy with some action sprinkled in? I can't, after a while, I don't know what they're really going for, and it just becomes hard to take something serious, even if it's supposed to be taken serious or not be taken serious.
So, what was an example of like the worst of the comedy in this film?
One of them was they're in a car. They have, spoilers, gotten out of the compound, and they're with Steve Buscemi in this truck. And he's giving them his credit card, and he's giving them some money, and he looks at Scarlett Johansson, and he says, look, I know you both are new at being humans, because they find out that they're clones. I know you both are new at this whole human experience thing, but here's a tip, or something, I'm paraphrasing, here's a tip, never let a woman hold your credit card. And I'm just like, what are we doing here? What
Let's
is
just throw
this?
A bit of casual sexism into this film.
Yeah, I'm just like, why are we, what is this bit? And then when Lincoln meets himself. Lincoln Six Echo meets regular Lincoln, like Link Thomas or whatever his name is. It's too buddy-buddy too quickly. And then it just feels like, you know, the jokes about like Maxim magazine and everything, which is funny because like Scarlett Johansson has been in those magazines as like sexiest person and all that stuff. Like some of it, I'm just like, okay, we get it. Like, talk about more of this world that we're in. Build this world up more. Don't just rely on the visuals for me to understand that we're in some type of future or some type of dystopia. Build the world for me some more, because I'm having a hard time understanding just how far ahead we are as a civilization, or how far ahead we think we are as a civilization. Because I think a lot of times with dystopian films, they explore that idea and they do it well, but this is one where they don't. I feel like it's just kind of tossed into the background. It'd be no different than like, oh, look at that mountain in the distance. It's not given that little bit extra attention, and it just doesn't really land for me.
Well, I think you're putting your finger on one of my biggest frustrations with this film, is that I think, like yourself, I think it does have a really great concept. And I think the first, struggle to put an exact time frame on it, but like the first 45 minutes, maybe up to about an hour, it's probably certainly the first 45 minutes, I think are really good. And for all the reasons that you were saying, you're kind of learning about this mysterious facility they're in, you're learning about this mysterious island, these characters, and you kind of know there's something shady going on, but you don't quite understand what it is. And that is, that part of the film is really great, and I'm really involved and really invested in this film. But then halfway through, the film just completely abandons all of this sort of mystery element and this, you know, this kind of dystopian, disturbing, you know, possible future of the world. It kind of abandons that and just basically turns into one big extended chase sequence. And I know you should sort of judge a film, you know, on its own terms. And certainly The Island is fine. I mean, it's decent. It's a decent watch. But I couldn't help but feel like I'm wanting, you know, especially after watching the first half of this film, wanting to have seen a different film, one which was much more sort of based inside that complex, with Ewan McGregor kind of doing maybe more like detective work to really get to the bottom of, you know, get to the bottom of the conspiracy that is going on there with these clones and the deceit that is being played out upon society with this kind of secret program that Sean Bean is masterminding. And yeah, I really didn't, I mean, all the car chase stuff is all fine. It's well executed. Some of it's actually quite exciting. But I would much rather have stayed with the kind of the sci-fi mystery of the first half of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And when the reveal comes, when he's leaving out of the space, and you could tell like, oh, everything is doctored up, and really they're in some type of silo, it's exciting, but only for a little bit. Because then it's just kind of, what do they do with it? And that's where the real letdown begins. Mm. And another thing that they don't really touch on, I feel, is the age of these clones, right?
Yeah.
They talk about how they've been in this facility some 2 years, 3 years, some 7 years, because the idea is that these were people that were rescued during a cataclysmic event, and they're brought in underground to keep away from the contamination. And there's one area in the world that's not contaminated, and if you win the lottery, we're going to send you there. It's going to be great. And it's like, okay, cool. So it's like a repopulation Adam and Eve kind of thing. So when they talk about that, and everyone's kind of acting their age for the most part, when they come to the outside world, it's as if they're seeing everything for the first time again, and they're infants and their children. But I'm confused about that, because they existed in the world previously. So why all of a sudden is it like, oh, you don't know how to drive a car, or you know how to drive a car, but you don't know what color the lights mean, or you don't know what a credit card, you don't know what all these different things are, yet you lived a life previously, or the memories are implanted to make it seem like they lived a life previously. So I'm just really confused at, are they the age they're supposed to be? Are they really a different age? What do they know versus what don't they know? Is it, I'm really confused by that aspect of it. And it feels like at times they play it up either for comedic value or to kind of, you know, oh, they can't, you know, drive the car, for example, or all of a sudden it goes to a chase and the issues that they have with that. Like, they play it up only when they need to, and then it's just kind of forgotten about the rest of the time. And it, that unevenness compared with the is it more comedy than action or action than comedy keeps it, I think, from getting to that next level of like, wow, like, you know, we were wrong about this movie. It's really good. Revisit it, blah, 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 that kind of thing.
Now, one of the big talking points when this film came out was the product placement, and specifically the kind of the amount of product placement and the manner of it. Now, you know, when we are, you know, when you are looking at this film from the vantage point of 2023, Nick, does the product placement seem that big of a deal to you? Is it still really glaring?
Oh, it's egregious. With a capital E. There's product placement where someone's walking through a town and you happen to see the McDonald's symbol in the background or a sign for a burger joint. For a couple seconds, that's fine because it's just in the background. But when there's a scene and it shows a beer bottle by itself, and then the camera zooms into the beer bottle as someone goes to pick it up and drink it and enjoy that beer, you're kidding me. You're kidding me that that's in a film. That's in a multi-million-dollar big budget film. That zoom in, it might as well had an explosion of ice around him when he took a sip. He should have looked right into the camera and just went, ah, so crisp and clean. Like, some of it was just so egregious. And I can understand if you're in a film where you're driving a car and you see the front of the car, you're going to see the car's logo. Some films do a pretty decent job of keeping it tucked away. Some just don't care. This is a film where clearly if you drove a certain manufacturer's type of car, logo was primarily displayed. And it was probably fancy to make it look like the future. And if you didn't pay up, they just took the logos off and kept it a very nondescript car, even though you can kind of piece together what it is. I think that just goes back to the consistency, because that shot with the beer bottle, I mean, that looks like it's right out of the Super Bowl. I mean, just, I've never seen such a perfect pan like that to a bottle. And then the way he drinks it, I'm like, this is just, that was so insane to me. I stopped and I kept rewinding it. I'm like, there's no way that it's just happening like that. But it was, and it is, and it did. And it felt gross. It felt a little bit gross. I'm like, why? Ugh.
Why are we dirtying ourselves in this way? Yeah, I mean, yeah. I hadn't watched this film in a long time before this rewatch. And as I say, I remember when this film came out. I remember all the ballyhoo about the product placement. And I was intrigued about going back to watch it now, because, you know, that form of marketing, I mean, it's just grown and grown and grown. It's become such a feature of TV, of films. And so I wondered whether I'd think it was still such a big deal in this film. And I'm the same camp as you, Nick. It's really, really in your face in a way which, yeah, you just think, this film came out this year, you'd be thinking, oh, this is, you know, they've taken it too far now. This is just insane in terms of the amount of advertising that is in there, and some of the scenes just feel like they're only there because, okay, we've got this large check from Xbox. We need to find a way of putting some sort of video game type scene into the film, because, you know, otherwise they're going to be unhappy with the amount of money they paid for their placement in this film. I thought the Xbox bat one was bad, but I actually think the worst one for me was towards the end of the film was the Ben and Jerry's ice cream one, where Scarlett Hansen just buys some ice creams pointlessly for some children.
I did not understand that
on the beach, and it's purely just to get Ben and Jerry's logo and product into the film. I mean, there is a very vague plot point on it, but there was absolutely, it seemed largely, okay, we've got to get Ben and Jerry's into this film. How are we going to do that? And that seemed to be the only motivation for the scene. So, yeah, was pretty awful.
It was the worst. Even that, I'm like, this is really happening right now. There's so many moments with these products that if you took the product out and had the scene, it would still be okay. Like, you could still have that scene and say whatever dialogue you wanted to say, or just cut it and make it a phone call. Just do something about it. It cheapens it, and it takes you out of it, too. You're supposed to be in this dystopian world. Why does that bottle look like a bottle that I could go out and buy right now? Why do they have, like, the exact logo for Ben & Jerry's? It should be different looking. It should be just something else. Put physical Ben & Jerry in there, little winks and nods for those of us that know what they look like, and have them serving, like, some other kind of weird, like, Jen and Barry ice cream, or just something off enough to make it just a touch believable. But when it's just in your face like that, like the Cadillac they were driving around and everything, I was like, we get it. Like,
I also wanted to talk to you because, you know, Nick, we're both, as I've mentioned before, we're both music fans, and I always intrigued by the musical careers of actors and actresses. And in this film, obviously, it co-stars a big early role for Scarlett Johansson, and she has actually recorded two albums of music. And Nick, I asked you to do a bit of homework for this episode and have a listen to them, and I actually listened to these albums myself after having failed to listen to Kiefer Sutherland's in the last episode that we recorded, although from your reviews it didn't sound like I'd missed out on anything. Anyway, yeah, Scarlett Johansson, the singer, the musician, what did you make of her LPs?
I think her voice is fine, but I think the style of music that she's choosing or has been chosen to sing just does not work for her. Anywhere I Lay My Head was the first album she did, which the entire album, except for, I think, what, one song? It's a Tom Waits cover album, which is a very bold declaration to be like, look, the first album I'm doing, it's all Tom Waits. And it's not like the Tom Waits songs that we know, because let's be honest, not everybody knows Tom Waits, right? It's not, let's go with the ones that are kind of more known. Let's go with some very deep cut, obscure ones from albums that were also kind of deep cut and obscure. I mean, she's pulling tracks from like Alice and the Black Rider and, you know, Orphans, and some of those, like, they don't get as much play as some of his other works. And I was very confused by the choices of songs for her to sing. But I think what made it worse was, I'm okay with singing it in a completely different style. If she wants to make, you know, I Wish I Was in New Orleans sound like a really sad Pet Shop Boys, or if she wants to sound like she's trying a riff on something by like Beach House, some kind of fuzzy dream pop, I'm okay with that, but it's got to be mixed well. I feel like this album wasn't mixed well, and it's just like all muddled and kind of one tone and bland. And the other album that she did, it just, that didn't really swing it for me either. I feel like it's like miscast almost.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, this musical career of Scarlett Johansson, it feels like it only exists because she's got some celebrity mates. And yeah. You know, she can carry a tune. I mean, it's not like she's awful as a singer or a kind of interpreter of other people's songs, as with the work that she does on that Tom Waits cover album, which, I mean, she pulls in there's some heavyweight musical talent involved in that particular album. Well, heavyweight's maybe a slight exaggeration, but you know, David Bowie is involved in that. There's the guitarist, I think, out of the Yeah Yeahs. There's musicians from Tall Furs and TV on the Radio, who were sort of all acts around in the noughties on that kind of independent alternative scene. So there's some, you know, proper like names that would get attention from people within the scene here. But as you say, it does feel like you are setting yourself up for a fall if you drag in all these people and then you say, yeah, I'm going to record an album of Tom, you know, the first record you do is going to be an album of Tom Waits covers. It just feels like you are setting yourself up for a bit of a fall. I mean, I didn't particularly care for that record myself. The other record that she did, which is a kind of collaboration with Pete Yawn, who has, I think most consensus is he's kind of like done one good record and that's about it. And I mean, it was a kind of shoulder shrug of an album, I think, that one that she does with Pete Yawn. It's fine, but I did read a good review of it where there was a line in that Pete Yawn album which said it was tastefully beige electronics brushed roots rock, which was the which I think summed it up perfectly.
That's absolutely a way to describe it. And it's so come and go too. It's not like there's a particular song or two where it's like, wow, look at the potential. Like if she did this, but with that, like, oh my God, she'd blow up. It's not that at all. They just come and go. I mean, that album she did with Pete Yawn, it's like not even a half hour. It's just so quick. At that point, it's an EP. Like it's a couple singles. Like I understand singing a song or two for a film, because I think she did that for like Sing or something like that. But I don't know, like if you're going to put a full album out there, like it just let it be you. Be you first and then be like, oh, you guys like my singing. Well, here's some of my favorite songs. Like I like a lot of Tom Waits. So now I'm going to be really super niche and put out an album of just Tom Waits stuff. Like give us a full introduction to who you are and what you're about and then be weird with it.
I'm inclined to agree with you, Nick. I'm inclined to agree with you. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
The best damn bounty hunter in the business.
I didn't do nothing. I'm clean.
No, I ain't no cop.
When they jump, he flips out. He's a professional.
We got some psycho running loose in the streets, and I'm the only son of a bitch who can bring him in for you.
Who's making out like a bandit.
I thought you were going to protect me.
The hell I am protecting.
But no, he's not out for the money.
What's your game, Kenna?
Who you are?
I want out.
And you're still the only one who knows what this guy looks like.
He's in for his life.
Damn you, Wilson!
Wings Hauser.
Black Kenna.
Reason to Die. Rated R. On video cassette from Bitmark Entertainment.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs after Ewan McGregor and ScarJo have escaped from their prison and are on the run in Los Angeles, chased by a group of mercenaries. Let us not dwell on the contrived circumstances that lead to our heroes finding themselves clinging to a sign attached to the side of a skyscraper. The aforementioned mercs turn up in a helicopter and open fire on Ewan and ScarJo. The sign, which has already been damaged by the previously mentioned contrived circumstances, topples off the side of the skyscraper and clips the helicopter, which with predictable good fortune has chosen to fly just underneath it. The helicopter, a Eurocopter 120B, bursts into flame. The wreckage falls to the ground where it crashes and explodes. Nick, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
I dug it. It's been a while since I've seen a helicopter that gets taken out by a falling sign. So it was different and it was exciting. I'm really surprised at how minimalist the explosion is. There's plenty of flame and there's a great big explosion and kind of a pop when it hits, but when it hits the ground, it's just kind of done. Like we don't really see that next step kaboom that I would hope to see in a Michael Bay film. And I don't know. It started off really strong. And then just when it ended, I was like, okay. Oh, okay. Like it felt very much like that. Like I wanted a little bit more out of it, but overall, I really dug it.
Well, I think the trouble is that there is so much wreckage not just from the helicopter, but from the sign that is falling off this building, that the helicopter rather gets sort of overshadowed by everything else that is happening in this particular sequence, with the sign crashing down, with the fate of Ewan McGregor and ScarJo, who are on top of this sign and somehow survive this fall from 70 stories. There's bits of sign falling on the sidewalk, falling onto cars and things. So that the helicopter just becomes just another piece of debris that is falling out of the sky. And I think that the exploding helicopter part of this sequence gets lost amidst all of the other stuff that is going on here, which is a shame, because as I'm sure we've talked about before, we like the exploding helicopter to be the star of any particular sequence.
Absolutely. And like you said, it becomes overshadowed. I think even in the scene when it explodes, the explosion is kind of hidden and tucked away after a while. Like, we see it happen and then it's slowly just put away and put behind us. And then we just watch it kind of fall and fall and fall and fall. And then when it hits, we still have the flames going, but like we don't have that extra impact. So I unfortunately have to agree with you that it just gets tossed to the side, and I don't care for that.
Now, while the exploding helicopter itself is a bit disappointing, there is some stuff in this film that I think exploding helicopter fans can really enjoy, because Nick, I don't know, have you ever seen the film Capricorn 1? It's a 1970s conspiracy thriller about the moon, landing on Mars being faked for the American public. Have you seen this film?
No, I haven't, but I feel like I've heard of it before, and I think it's something that I want to see, I think.
Well, you no doubt have heard of it, because you dutifully listened to the Exploding Helicopter podcast episode that I recorded on Capricorn 1. There's a very knowing nod towards Capricorn 1 in this particular film. So one of the sort of famous elements of Capricorn 1 is these two what are called the black helicopters, which are searching for the astronauts after they go on the run, once they realize the conspiracy that they are sort of involved in. And there is these great sequences of these helicopters hunting for these astronauts in the middle of this sort of desert, and the helicopters fly in spookily synchronized fashion, and they almost there are sort of moments where the helicopters almost are like characters in their own right and seem to be sort of silently communicating to each other. It's a well done bit of aerial coordination in order to actually sort of convey, I know, the sort of the scale of the sinister conspiracy, and to convey some, you know, extra elements, to some sort of human elements to these helicopters. And there's definitely, if you have seen Capricorn 1, some of the early sequences in this film where these two helicopters are hunting Scarlett Johansson, Ewan McGregor, it's undoubtedly a callback to Capricorn 1. There is no way that isn't a direct and knowing nod towards that particular film. And in Capricorn 1, those two black helicopters, obviously, as you would expect, come a cropper. So, yeah, exploding helicopter fans can enjoy that very in-the-know callback to that film. And, Nick, I also noticed that The helicopter pilot in this film was a guy called Alan Perwin. Now, you probably don't know the name, Nick, but I think you'll know some of the films that he has been in, because he specializes in filming aerial sequences, in being a stunt helicopter pilot. And I had a look through his CV, and he's been in, he's kind of been involved in the helicopter sequences of films from Die Hard, True Lies, Shadow Conspiracy, The Sum of All Fears, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, Fast and Furious 7, Tropic Thunder. I mean, in total, he has been in 14 films that feature an exploding Whoa. Helicopter, which is, a hell of a career by any definitions.
Yeah, it is. And to be a part of some big ones like that is, it's just kind of cool. I dig that.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this episode, Nick. Thanks for joining me once again. Is there anything you've got going on at the moment that you want to plug?
I do, yes. If you head over to rabbitholepodcasts.com, I am a co-host on both Lyrical Innuendo and Play MST for Me. Go check those out. Also, check out the Forgotten Filmcast with Todd Liebenow. I was just on the 199th episode. We talked about the 1975 film Hearts of the West. It stars Jeff Bridges and Alan Arkin, Blythe Danner, Andy Griffith. I had a really good time watching it and talking about it, and I think you'll have a good time listening to Todd and myself talk about it. So check it out on the Forgotten Filmcast.
Well, after you've done that, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website for more reviews and information about films where helicopters explode. If you can rate, review, or retweet us and help spread the word about what we're doing, I'd be very grateful. Exploding Helicopter is now on Blue Sky, so if you want to find us there, yeah, come and do so. We'll be back soon, but until then, what should people do, Nick?
Keep watching the blue sky for those exploding helicopters. This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.